This is the title. It could just as well, given what I'm going to focus on, be about linking cognitive neural levels of explanation. I'm going to start by motivating the work by briefly reviewing some things that some of you have heard, because we've talked about them at other meetings in past years. A lot of people that haven't been there, so I'll have to kind of motivate some of the newer things with an explanation of that earlier work. So my lab for a long time has been interested kind of broadly in perceptual decision making, how we categorize, identify and detect objects. We look at the errors people make, why people are fast or slow, how speed or accuracy change with learning. We develop cognitive models that instantiate hypotheses that we have about the underlying mechanisms. The work I'm going to talk about today is efforts we've been doing over the last several years to try to link those with kind of neural levels of explanation. So given a particular task, like identifying an object, right, we come up with a mechanistic model to kind of fill in that black box. And the particular models I'm going to be focusing on today are really members of a broad class that are called accumulation of evidence models or stochastic accumulation of evidence models. I'm going to tend to focus on models that are illustrated this way. For those of you who know these models, these are random walk or diffusion models, but there's actually a broad class of models that all fit within the same category. And we actually don't look at just a single model generally, we look at the broader class. In general, these models assume that there's a certain amount of time it takes to perceptually process an object. The outcome of perceptual processing is evidence, which is noisy and needs to be accumulated over time. And it's when that evidence reaches a critical level or a threshold that a particular response can be made at a particular time. And one of the important components of variability that we see, both in terms of errors but also in terms of the distribution of response times, is in terms of variability in this stochastic accumulation to a threshold. Now, there's lots of different models, lots of different variations. I've just put a subset of the sites. These models have been around for going on almost 50 years. And they're relatively low parameterized compared to, say, more complicated neural models. I'm going to be focusing in particular in some of the results I'll eventually get to on just two of these, one of them being the rate of accumulation, right? So how much evidence do you have that's kind of stochastically accumulated over time? That's the drift rate. And the other being the threshold. So how much information do you need to accumulate in order to make a certain response? Okay. Now, the focus of today's talk is really on the temporal dynamics part. In other work we've been doing for years, some of it funded by the center, it's been tying this temporal model with a learning model, right? So what is the front end, and how does that explain how accuracy and time changes the function of learning? But I'm not going to be talking about that work today. Okay, so in the world of kind of cognitive models, right, we typically think about using these mechanistic models and relating them to various patterns of observed behavior, errors people make, times, distributions of times, how those times and accuracy change with learning. And, you know, a very kind of cartoon idea is that, if you have neural data, you need a neural model, right? Now, Ken Harris talked about, you know, certainly a lot of work for a long time about trying to link these kind of neural level models with behavior. What I'm going to talk about kind of in this introduction is efforts that have been growing to try to take these higher level cognitive models and relate them back to neural data. Now, work I'm not going to talk about is a lot of interesting work, especially over the last several years, trying to take these kind of cognitive level models and using them to understand things like ERPs and fMRI. So instead of correlating brain activity with stimuli or responses, you correlate parameters of models, right? So maybe some parts of the brain are more associated with something like the drift rate. Other parameters might be more associated with adjusting the threshold. And there's some really cool work that Brandon Turner has been doing, which actually tries to simultaneously model behavior with a model, with fMRI, on the one hand getting you kind of more theoretically satisfying patterns of brain activity, but also perhaps providing more statistical power to be able to detect small differences in brain activity. That's not work I'm going to talk about. It's just to motivate. The work I'm going to be talking about and focusing on is work we've done, but lots of other labs have been doing over the last decade, really trying to relate these kind of cognitive level accumulator models to neurophysiology. Now, I'm not a neurophysiologist. I'm a cognitive modeler, but I collaborate with Jeff Shaw, who's at Vanderbilt, who looks at Single unit recordings, sometimes multi-unit, sometimes LRPs, to try to understand where and when a monkey moves its eye. So what patterns of brain activity in terms of single units are associated with decisions that monkeys make to move their eyes to particular objects in a visual field. And glossing over lots of details, the focus of this work has largely been on the frontal eye field. There's lots of different neurons in frontal eye field. The focus of their work and the work that we've done following up has been on a couple of different classes of neurons. One class called visually responsive neurons responds to whether something's important at a particular location in a visual field. So they don't respond to particular features. They respond to what's important given that task that the monkey's doing, regardless of whether the monkey actually moves its eyes or not. And then there's another class of neurons that seems to ramp up its activity to a threshold. It ramps up quickly when the monkey makes a quick response and ramps up more slowly when the monkey makes a slow response. Okay, so that's some of the neurophysiology. Braden Purcell, who was a graduate student in my lab, now a postdoc at NYU, asked whether perhaps this is a neural signature of the results of perceptual processing that give rise to the information that drives the drift rate. And he did that in probably the most direct way possible by essentially replacing parameters of this high-level cognitive model with the neurophysiology itself. Take the raw neural signals, use them to define the inputs to an accumulator model that predicts where and when the monkey moves its eyes, in particular the errors that they make and the time that they make to make those responses. Now, this is illustrating, I'm glossing over details again about the particulars of the experiment, but we predict quantitatively distributions of response times and accuracy. Other models can't. So we actually look at kind of families of models that make various kinds of assumptions, and we're able to rule out certain models and kind of keep other models that are able to successfully predict the behavior. But in addition, right, so if we think that the accumulators in the model are actually doing the same kind of computations as the movement-related neurons in the brain, we can not just say, well, they look similar, right, but we can actually measure the accumulators in the model and the neurons in the brain in exactly the same way. And in fact, we're able to predict in a parameter-free way the physiology that's actually observed in the animal. Okay. Again, some models can do that, other models can't. We can use that as a way of determining what the right model is. Okay. So it's interesting, but it's also a bit of a puzzle, right? So on the one hand, we have this fairly abstract cognitive model, relatively few parameters, that's able to predict the behavior of the organism, right? But at the same time, we have this fairly abstract cognitive model that's also explaining what's happening in terms of single units, single neurons in the brain, right? And so the work I'm going to try to talk about today, in whatever time I have left, kind of illustrates our attempts to really try to kind of make the links, kind of try to really understand the scaling relations between these higher level cognitive models and what's happening in terms of physiology. It's one thing to say, look, we have the same model explaining neurons and explaining behavior. It's another thing to try to understand how you can have that kind of simultaneously match it. Two very different levels of abstraction. So I'm going to give you two hints at some of the work we're doing to really try to understand that. Okay. So in a typical situation, right, we're dealing with an organism or the organism's brain. They produce data. We fit a model like the diffusion model to that data by adjusting these free parameters. And then, for example, if we have a certain experimental manipulation that results in a change in the drift rate, right, we might say, well, look, there's a part of the brain that's involved in doing some kind of perceptual coding, right, of a stimulus. But maybe that same experimental manipulation has no effect on the threshold, right? So it's all about the input. It's not about the decision process. But perhaps there's another experimental manipulation, a different one, that produces changes in threshold, right? Instructions to subjects, payoffs, right? And maybe that's associated with a different pattern of brain activity, right? Now, of course, when we're dealing with an organism or a whole brain, right, we don't know if simply because that activity is correlated with some pattern of brain activity that it's actually a threshold, right? Certainly it's reasonable given the model, but we don't have any direct evidence that that's the actual mechanism. Right, and it's hard, especially with humans, to try to manipulate some of the underlying neural parameters directly. But what we've done instead is say, well, can we take a model which is at a very different level of abstraction, I'm going to gloss over a lot of the details of the model. I could spend 15 minutes talking about the models that Xiaoxing Wang has been using over the last 10 or 15 years. These are models with thousands of spiking neurons. They kind of respect a lot of the underlying physiology and anatomy. There's lots and lots of free parameters, right? And kind of use that as a surrogate for a brain, right? So can I actually go in and manipulate parameters of this very low-level neural model, fit the diffusion model to those simulated data, just like I would fit them to a human data, and see how the parameters that I recover from the fitting relate to the underlying neural mechanisms that I've injected because I'm the one who's creating the data, okay? So the same thing we had before, right? But now the data are coming from another model, right? And I'm not saying that this is the right model. It's a successful model. It's a popular model, right? We can replace lots of different models for that, right? So this is just an exercise to try to understand something about what the diffusion model, this high-level cognitive model, could be telling us about the underlying kind of neural mechanisms, okay? And so the basic idea, I'm going to run through this fairly quickly just to give you an illustration of what we've been doing, is to kind of now introduce variability in some of the parameters of this model. Okay, one of them is simply the gain of or the input sensitivity of information that's flowing into this kind of model that is intended to capture the decisions of an organism. And we look at predicted, now this is actually showing predictions, and also, we look at simulated data from this neural model, and then this is actually showing how well the diffusion model fits. But basically, we find that as we manipulate this input sensitivity, we get faster responses and more accurate responses, which kind of seems intuitive, right, given the parameter that we're manipulating. And then when we fit the diffusion model, again, not surprisingly, this is kind of a reality check, we see that threshold that's recovered when I fit the diffusion model to the data is constant, right? And it's only the drift rate, the inputs, right? So that's just reality check. That shouldn't be surprising. It didn't have to work out that way, right? Because on one hand, we're talking about a high-level cognitive model. On the other hand, we're talking about a spiking neuron model with thousands and thousands of units. So this is a good thing, right? We can do kind of the other side. It turns out this neural model is actually thousands and thousands of kind of neural accumulators, actually kind of set up as being little neural integrators, right? So the model actually assumes, just like the diffusion model, that there's a threshold that determines the response, and so we can manipulate that threshold up and down in the model, generate some predicted data. Now we get a speed accuracy trade-off, as we should. So as we increase the threshold, responses are slower and they're more accurate, right? And when we fit the diffusion model, we get, kind of, again, as a reality check, what we might expect, right? The drift rate doesn't change, right, in terms of fitting it to the model, to the data that's produced by the spiking model, but threshold changes, right? What was surprising to us is that, okay, well, now those kind of map naturally onto the diffusion model, right? Something about the input gain, something about the threshold, but the spiking model has lots of other parameters that have absolutely no analog in these spiking neuron models. Like, one of them happens to be the recurrent excitation of neurons within particular pools associated with particular responses. That has no associate, there's nothing in the diffusion model that's like that, right? When we actually simulate the model, now injecting kind of variability in terms of the amount of recurrent excitation systematically, right, more or less recurrent excitation, we get faster responses, less accurate responses. Again, a speed accuracy trade-off in terms of the predicted, or in terms of the data that's produced. And when we fit the diffusion model, right, we see that all of the variability is coming in threshold, not in drift rate, right? So even though the underlying mechanism had nothing to do with the threshold, when we fit the diffusion model to that data, right, we would say that it's a threshold, but it's not a threshold change. The model also assumes that there's kind of the sensitivities of particular receptors. So, for example, NMDA conductance, that's a, you know, from my perspective as a cognitive model, that's a knob that I can twist and I can play with in terms of producing simulated data. That also produces a speed accuracy trade-off, right? Changing that produces faster responses, also less accurate responses. And when we fit the diffusion model, we see no changes in drift rate, and we see consistent changes in threshold, right? Now, on the one hand, you know, perhaps this isn't surprising, right? There's a whole lot of parameters in these neural models, right? That have no analog in the diffusion model, right? So there's a many-to-one mapping, but there's not a many-to-many mapping, right? It's not that if we start injecting these things that have no correspondence in the diffusion model, like the recurrent excitation, that now it's some combination of drift rate and threshold and perceptual processing time and variability, right? There seems to be some consistency in terms of which parameters in the spiking model map onto which parameters in something like the diffusion model. So in that sense, these higher level cognitive models are sufficient when all you want to do is understand something about the behavior, right? They capture the regularity that would be non-identifiable if all you had was behavioral data. Now, if you have neural data, right, you actually go in and do pharmacological manipulations, obviously you can be playing around with a lot more parameters here. But in terms of the variability that we see in terms of behavior, right, this may be capturing those important regularities in kind of principled ways, right? That said, seeing a threshold change in something like a diffusion model doesn't necessarily mean the underlying mechanism has to be something that's like a threshold. How much time do I have left?
9 minutes.
Okay. All right. So there's a lot more I could say there. I just wanted to kind of paint the picture of some of the work we're doing in terms of that kind of mapping. Right. The other question that we were interested in was the one I posed earlier, which is how can we have the same model, and I've explained the behavior of the whole brain, of the organism, while simultaneously explaining not the behavior of an ensemble of neurons, but of a single neuron, right? So we have this kind of interesting kind of levels problem, right? That is interesting to point out, but it's also puzzling, right? That we can have the same model explain things at such completely different levels of analysis, okay? And I'm not sure we've answered that question, but we've started to try to understand maybe some of the principles that might be at work and trying to understand why this could be the case. And there's a paper, I think it just came out this week, where we kind of systematically looked at what happens as we start to scale up the ensembles of neurons that contribute to a particular response. Now, I need to make something really clear. So we've done a lot of work, lots of labs have done a lot of work looking at how you can model multiple responses, right? So lots of experiments we do are two choice, but we've done six choice, 10 choice. These models are really scalable in terms of how many responses there might be and how many accumulators there might be that are associated with each of those responses, right? So that's, you know, there's still a lot of interesting import work that needs to be done on that, but that's something that a lot of work has been done in trying to understand. What happens is you increase the number of potential responses, right? What we've done, which is something I don't think has really been addressed, is recognizing that if you really think that there are these neural accumulators that are associated with particular responses, right, what happens as you start not increasing the number of potential responses, right, but what happens is you start to increase the number of accumulators that are associated with the same response, right? So if you have pools of neurons that are all acting like accumulators, right, how can we go from one accumulator in a diffusion model that explains behavior to thousands of neurons that might be at work, say, in frontal eye field, right? Where each one of them kind of acts like it's a diffusion in and of its own, right? So we're now looking at this other kind of axis, right? Now, typically, a cognitive model will have one accumulator per response, and a neural model will have 10,000 accumulators per response, right? We're trying to understand what happens as we actually look across that dimension, right? Not kind of treating them as simply two different ways of thinking about developing models. Okay, so one of the key manipulations then is ensemble size, right? Not ensembles associated with different responses, ensembles associated with the same response. Okay, now to illustrate this, I just have a little animation here to kind of show you what the graphs are gonna look like. So this is the focus here is really, and this work is really on time, right? So we set up situations where you can imagine they're well-learned kind of decisions, so the variability is not in terms of accuracy, the variability is in terms of response time, in particular response time distributions. So there's just a cartoon of a response time distribution. We can imagine dividing that up into quintiles, right, as a way of describing the response time distribution. We can rotate it on its side, right? And now what I'm going to be showing you is Now, not just how mean RT varies with ensemble size, but pictures of how the distributions change with ensemble size, right? So here it's just one set of answers. Now, this is assuming there's 10 accumulators associated with a single response, right? We can sweep out that whole, what's that?
Are these independent, like you're running 1,000 different models at the same time, and
they're aggregating. There's an aggregation. I'll get the, maybe I'll
they couple to each other in terms of their aggregation?
One sec. Yeah, this will hopefully be answered in a second. So, so we have a single RT distribution here. Whoops. There we go. And now we're showing how the predicted RT distributions vary as a function of the number of accumulators. Now, clearly, with only one accumulator, the response time distribution is different than what we see with 10, right? But there's this regime where whether it has 10, 100, 1,000, we've also looked at 10,000 accumulators. In terms of the predicted variability, there's an invariance, right? It doesn't matter whether you have 10, whether you have 1,000, but what's key, getting to Jay's question, is that one of the other things we looked at wasn't just ensemble size, it was the degree of correlation in the accumulation rates, right? And so this is with a correlation of 0.2. We also looked at, right, so if you have thousands of accumulators, we looked at different rules for how you would kind of pool across those. I think given the time I have left, I'm doing good, okay. So we, given 1,000 accumulators, how can you kind of aggregate across all those responses, right? One is just simply average their responses into a master accumulator. That's actually how the XJ Wang's models work. There's kind of a master accumulator that makes the final decision. You could also imagine saying, well, if each of those are accumulators, you could say, well, I'm gonna make a response when half of them finish. Make a response when the first one finishes, or the last one finishes, right? Or some intermediate, right? There's more complicated mechanisms. We try to keep things fairly simple. Okay.
Is that n equals 1,000 line? Looks like the n equals 1 line. Is that just the?
This is, you'll see in a sec. So this is one condition. This is, you know, so we're going to be looking at the degree of correlation between the accumulators, the what we call kind of the stopping rule, how we aggregate across the accumulators. So this particular condition says that 30% of the accumulators have to hit their threshold. Then you make a response. The other 70%, right, they haven't yet hit the threshold, we're just going to ignore them, right? And so that's actually a panel within kind of a full simulation where we're looking at correlations along this axis, going from completely uncorrelated to perfectly correlated, and the termination rule along this axis, where this is the response is given whenever the first thing hits its threshold, the last thing hits its threshold, or something that's intermediate. And this is where all of the things are just pooled together into an average according to one threshold. Okay. And the real take home for this is that eventually, so if each of these is showing how our RT distributions change as a function of ensemble size, right? That's what's happening within each one of these panels, right? Within most of the space of possible parameterizations, you get out to 10, 50 accumulators, right? Going to 500, going to 1,000 simply doesn't matter. The predictions you get with 10 or 50 is exactly the same as you get with 1,000, 10,000, or 100,000. The key, though, is that they have to have some degree of correlation, right? If things are perfectly uncorrelated, right, the variability in RTs goes to zero. And there needs to be some kind of either intermediate pooling mechanism, intermediate rule for kind of deciding how you make a response or pooling them, because if you just pick the first, you just pick the last, you're in the world of kind of extreme value statistics and the predictions kind of fall apart, right? So we find that there's this kind of invariance that regardless of ensemble size, right, the RT distributions remain the same. Now the actual RT distributions change according to the termination rule and accumulation rate. So in terms of what's fast and what's slow and how much variability, right, it's sensitive to those particular parameters. But in terms of, you know, saying, you know, do you have to have N, where N is the number of things engaged in the ensemble, right, as long as it's big enough, right, you don't have to worry about, at least given the constraints of the kinds of models we looked at, you don't have to worry about that being a parameter that is going to be sensitive. Once they're big enough, the behavior of the ensemble remains invariant. Okay, so that's what I just said, that, you know, so we found that there's this, you know, we didn't predict this ahead of time, right? So we figured there might be some part of the space that you might see something that's invariant, right? But it turns out it's almost all the space where this invariance is observed with large enough ensemble sizes. Okay. So I hope I've shown you that we can like start with these kind of cognitive level models, make connections to underlying physiology, use physiology to constrain models, but also if we're going to make this mapping between abstract models and neural models, right, there's questions about how you actually can have the same model explain physiology on the one hand and behavior on the other hand. So thank you.